campers, rise and shine, and don't forget those gloves and masks, because we're social distancing out here today.
We're social distancing every day. What is this, Miami Beach?
Not hardly, and you know, you can expect no travel later today with that, you know, that lockdown thing.
That lockdown thing? That lockdown thing. Oh, well, here's the report. The CDC is calling for a big lockdown thing.
Yes, they are. But you know what? There's another reason why today is especially exciting.
Especially boring.
Especially boring. Okay. But the big question on everybody's lips?
On their chapped lips.
On their chapped lips. Right. Do you think the doctor is going to come out and free us from the lockdown?
The doctor?
That's right, time travelers, because it's...
quarantine!
What's good, fam? This is The Queer Archive, a queer and feminist Doctor Who podcast. I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Brenna.
And this week we're talking about the 9th episode of Series 10, Empress of Mars.
Let's pull to open to talk about Bill's braid and, you know, some other stuff. Okay, pull to open. Initial thoughts. What do we got?
Good morning to Bill and Bill's ponytail braid only.
What, bitch? Don't talk to me. I got a ponytail.
Yes, it is very good.
Speaking of gorgeous hair, oh my god, Leslie Ewan, those locks though.
Yeah, they're really beautiful.
She shows up in like the first 2 minutes of the
NASA
episode
scene.
In the room of NASA, yeah. I definitely absolutely looked her up on IMDb because I wanted to know what else she's been in and if she's always had that beautiful hair. And I was cackling because I immediately saw that she's been in an episode of The L Word and plays, I quote, butch lesbian. That's her character. Of course.
I do. I love a Star Wars mom, and I, too, have a bad feeling about this episode.
Every time.
I got a bad feeling about this.
Plays the clip in my mind.
I do. I hate Catch Love so much. His face is so punchable.
What a punchable face.
I just...
The minute he steps on screen, right?
Yes, it is a face that demands to be punched, truly.
Absolutely. And speaking of his introduction, he's actually wearing a really awesome getup that definitely reminds me of Dirk Gently every time, because he's in that super steampunk suit.
Yeah. The ear
yep.
funnel thingy.
Yep.
I forget what it's actually called, and I won't look it up because I'm lazy.
It's on
but
the record players.
Yeah, it's really great.
I keep wanting to say xylophone, but that's definitely not right. Yeah, moving on. Okay.
Those suits look great. What does not look great is the Ice Queen's sarcophagus. The gems look like they came out of a pretty, pretty princess box. They are so plastic.
I definitely had those gems growing up. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I've got to say, so the way the episode begins and ends with these stones.
Yeah.
So you're telling me those stones remained in place all those years? The fuck? Throughout centuries, just chilling on the surface of Mars, undisturbed? They weren't even that big of stones. It's not Stonehenge. They were like small stones.
I know, they're like pebbles that they could move.
They moved them with their bare hands.
With their bare hands?
Yeah. The bare ones. I was so confused. I was like, we're supposed to believe this? Anyways, yeah. On another note of futile interrogation of the episode's plot holes, I also just don't buy that at the end, the Ice Queen wouldn't be able to get out of that weak-ass knife hold by Neville.
Yeah, he can, like, barely reach around Araxa's
with
carapace.
All of her
There's no
armor,
way.
Like,
yeah.
I don't even think the knife was touching her throat.
No, it didn't really look like
it. Was, like, barely. Like, she was, like...
Also, he's a little sure, bitch. She could have totally pulled Sing on him and just...
Solaplexus, instep, nose, point!
Did she not have her, like, zapper zap zap? She could have just zapped his foot and he would have been a little crinkle ball.
Yeah.
Like...
Turn him into a knot. That's what he deserves. I kept waiting for it to happen and I forgot that it didn't until the episode was over.
A slap.
I mean, he gets shot in the gut, so I guess there's that. But I wanted him to be a pretzel.
And then shoot the pretzel. And
yes.
then slap.
And then set
space.
It on fire.
Set it on fire twice.
Okay, I've had enough random thoughts. Let's gloss past these plot holes and head for the High Council of Gallifrey.
Let's go. All right, we're up in the High Council of Gallifrey again. And this is a segment where we talk about folks and the power positions in the world of Who production. The sergeants, the caps.
Yeah. Written who by we got? Gatiss.
Sweet Jesus.
But glory, glory, hallelujah. It's the last time we're going to have to talk about a Gatiss episode.
Yeah! May he never return to Doctor Who. Ugh. Unless he's acting. That's fine, I guess.
Yeah, I think he's good in acting.
He is.
Apparently Chibnall invited him and their schedules just didn't work out. And I was like, keep not working out. Keep not working out.
Whatever you're doing instead, congratulations.
Dracula, I think.
Is he really?
Yeah, of course he is. He's kosher.
Whatever's Moffat's doing, Gatiss is too.
I mean, there's something really to be said about the if I have a job, you have a job pact with a friend. So I'm into that. I like that Moffat is like, as long as I'm working, you're working to somebody, because that shows me that he is a human being. But also, I don't want to read Gatiss scripts ever.
But isn't that what all white dudes do? They're like, you get me, you get my whole clan.
I was thinking about Lin-Manuel, because he said that to Javier Munoz. If I have a job, you have a job.
Oh, that's cute.
Because Javier is the one who's always his understudy and then his replacement.
For sure.
Anyways. Originally, I read this and I was like, ooh! Originally, this was going to be a sequel to Sleep No More. Ew! And can you fucking imagine?
We don't need that.
No, we didn't need the first
sleep
one.
Sleep No More. We definitely don't need... We need Sleep No Less.
Yes.
Wait, no.
It's good. Moving on.
Almost a great pun.
I do think this is the least hateable Gatiss script. Yeah, I'll give him that.
That is totally fair because, like, what do we have to compare to? The worst episodes of Doctor Who?
Yeah, I think the other one that we were like, this is okay. Robots is fine, I guess.
Robots was at least a good time.
Yeah, and I do like the Jammy Dodger episode. But I'll bet if I rewatched it, I wouldn't.
You like that one moment in the
I like the colorful Daleks. The Jammy Dodger moment is funny, but I really just like that the Daleks are colorful.
Deeply on brand.
Okay. I know. Shout out to Ray Holman for another sweet ass spacesuit design. These suits that they're wearing, I think they're pretty slick. And I feel like it must be slick. Yeah, and I feel like it would be hard to have to keep designing spacesuits. Like, you just make so many. Yeah. And this design feels different and fresh, and it's interesting. I like the black iridescent material that's in, like, little squares, and I do like the harness design. It's just, it's a cute suit.
How do both the Doctor and Bill look really fresh in there?
I know.
They're rocking it.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Have we accidentally become a Ray Holman stan podcast?
I don't think it was accidental. I've always liked his costumes.
I had just now noticed how amazing he is.
Yeah, he's so good. He's so good. Costuming is one of those things that they're, like, quietly working really hard to immerse you in the story. I remember one time, I used to teach this summer class where we would go to the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. And because it was an educational experience, we would get sit-downs with, like, some actors, some production people. And we got to meet with the head costumer one year, and she just talked us through one set of costumes from one production of Lear. No, it was The Tempest. So she just talked us through one set of costumes from a production of The Tempest. And it was down to, like, the choice of fabric. She was like, Prospero is kind of a coarse person. Like, he's rough around the edges. So his costumes, we chose these textiles because they have texture to them, but they're not soft. And they don't look soft and flowy because that's not Prospero. And I was like, what the fuck? And it just made me realize how much a costumer can really transform the thing that you're watching. And Ray does that regularly, where if you sit and look at it, it's like really fascinating. But most of the time it's in there doing a supporting role to move ideas forward.
Right.
That's some good
it's
shit.
It's like they're artists or something.
I know.
Damn. Actually, I've always noticed all of these costumes that Ray has done. I just never assigned it to the costume designer because I've never been looking up these facts. So now that I'm like, oh, this is all one dude just hitting it out of the park every time.
Yeah.
Just respect, you know?
Imagine being the costume designer for the entire run of New Who and just nailing it almost all the time.
Why would you hire anyone else?
Why would you?
So good. I mean, my next note is actually technically still costume design because one thing I love just aesthetically about this episode is the dusty red Mars environment contrasting with the really iridescent, shiny green bio armor.
Yeah.
That's my jam.
Yep.
There was a couple of amazing shots. So when we shout out the director, Wayne Yip, those two were working together really well this episode.
Yeah.
Just really great shots that just, like, focused in on a lot of the great costume design.
Yep. Speaking of which, this episode was directed by Wayne Yip. Wayne did the last one, and he also did Resolution, like we said in our previous episode.
I think he does consistently solid work.
I think he's good, yeah.
Yeah. The subtle camera shake and the tea set rattling every time the Gargantua was making a blast, that was also nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot one thing about, not necessarily costume design, maybe set design. Outside of
the whole Infinity Sarcophagus.
Toys R Us gemstones. The hive was pretty dope.
Yeah.
I thought that whole room was pretty cool.
The, like, structure, yeah.
Yeah. And then the way that they lit up as you did, like, a spiral zoom out to the ceiling.
Yes.
Sweet. Yeah.
Well, Wayne and Ray understood the assignment and did the homework. At least those two did. We can talk about all the rest in the Black Archive.
All right, we're back in the Black Archive. Let's talk about that big, scary, forbidden stuff. Here we examine things like race, class, sexuality, gender, bodies, and all that fun stuff. What do we got?
I have to talk about Robinson Crusoe, don't I?
Size and literature teacher.
I complained about this in our first episode. Okay, here's the quick and dirty. Robinson Crusoe was written by Daniel Defoe. Well, it was published in 1719, probably written over the course of a year. It actually kicks off. It's a really important book in terms of, like, the novel as we now know it. Novels didn't, they didn't really exist up until this point. But realistic fiction becomes the course of the day because Robinson Crusoe is written like a travelogue. It's like his journals. So it's epistolary. It's made up of his journal entries, mostly. Robinson Crusoe travels on a ship to find his fortune. There's some mishaps in there, but on one of his ship trips, the ship crashes and he is landed on a deserted island by himself. So he has to, over the course of 28 years, he has to learn how to, you know, live on his own. So he learns how to hunt, he farms his own grain, he figures out how to plant grapes and then dry them to make raisins, he builds a bunch of locations, he even establishes what he calls his vacation home on the other side of the island.
Wait, hold on.
Yeah.
He
plants the seeds from grapes.
He plants grapes so that he can make raisins?
Yes.
Why wouldn't you just eat grapes? Raisins are disgusting.
Robinson Crusoe is stupid.
That actually
raisins
holds
are
up.
Humiliated grapes.
Yeah. And he's a colonizer bitch, so
he is
of course
a colonizer
bitch.
Raisins. Yeah.
Sorry to anyone who likes raisins. It's not, does not equate to being a colonizer, but gross.
It is.
I just had to interrupt. Yeah. Sorry.
He also, no, you're fine.
Like, did I hear that right?
You did.
Why don't you just eat the damn grapes?
No, he's stupid. He, well, he's not that stupid because he finds the native goats on the island and he tames them and then starts caring for them and thus he can have goat's milk and he makes his own cheese. He finds some cats and dogs on the island, which he then he calls them his family. It's, like, cute if it wasn't actually literally a sign of mental breakdown. Because he is, in his journal, he's like, maybe I'm going crazy. But he has, like, this little life that he's carved out for himself on the island. And then I think around year 22 or 24, he sees cannibals on the island. Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. And he watches them kill and eat people. And at first, he's, like, determined to kill them because he thinks they're doing this monstrous deed. But then there's actually a kind of interesting section where he's like, well, actually, that's not fair because they don't know what they're doing is wrong. Like, it's right to them because it's how they live their life, which is, like, the only good thought Robinson Crusoe has on the island. Anyways, he ends up...
I mean, it's kind of paternalistic. I heard that
growing up. It is paternalistic.
Like, they don't know what's right
for them. They know
not
what they do.
I know because I'm a civilized, evolved person,
that
and I know good from right.
Yeah.
Good from right. Right from wrong. Wow. Anyways, go on.
But he has dreams of capturing one or two cannibals to make them into his slave servants.
Cool.
I don't like that word.
With mainframe?
No. Why would I not like mainframe? No, the... Yes word.
Prisoners with jobs.
Okay. Anyways, he does end up, he saves Friday. They're going to kill Friday. Anyways, he saves a cannibal and he names him Friday. You see where the connection's starting to come in? That was such a long segue. But he teaches Friday English and converts him to Christianity. And then Friday eventually comes with him when they get off the island and he goes to England with Robinson Crusoe. So troubling portrayals of indigeneity and Manifest Destiny colonizer trash. All that to say, I don't know if Gatiss calls Friday Friday because he thinks it's cute or because he thinks there's like a larger parallel to be made between the humans' attempts to colonize Earth or colonize Mars and the Crusoe story. Like this.
It's got to be the second, right?
I guess this episode comes out. Like, in the end, it comes up looking a little, like, skeptical towards imperialism as an idea, but I don't know.
I think it's pretty overtly skeptical.
Yeah, well, my thing
at least
is...
it's, like, stance on it.
My thing is, Gatiss doesn't ever... like, a Gatiss script doesn't ever seem to actually know what it's saying, which is that's why I'm like, true. I don't know if that's what you're actually doing, or if you were just like... I'm putting this parallel here because I think it's fun. Because British people are, like, proud of Robinson Crusoe, even though it's a trash book. And it brings my heart so much joy to ruin it for my students every year when I teach it.
Hate Welcome, it. Bitches. Dang. That's troubling.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I want to say it's the second where he's like, obviously, I made this dude look like a dumbass. And he's all like, British, we belong everywhere, blah, yeah. blah. But... I don't know. It's not that interesting of a script. I don't think it's that radical or subversive.
No, I think on the subreddits, because everyone's bored and just trying to start drama, somebody asked, what do you think of Mark Gatiss episodes? And a bunch of people, it actually shocked me, a bunch of people were like, I really like them. And I was like, what the fuck is the matter with all of you? But then somebody said, I don't prefer them, but when there's a Gatiss episode, I know that I just have to adjust my expectations for it to be something silly. And that actually, I was like, oh yeah, that's actually a helpful reframing, that it is silliness. And not okay like, this silly. Is fun and silly. Like,
be these silly about Robin Hood. Don't be silly about colonizing bullshit.
Yeah, like, and see, this is exactly why I'm like, yeah. I don't know if it's the second one. It feels like it's supposed to be the second one, but I just don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
It's just, it's not a silly topic. It's, no. Unless you're doing, like, there's obviously ways that you can do it from the perspective of someone who actually has... the real life impacts
yeah.
in their lives.
It would have to
you
be
don't.
It would
You're
have to
from
be
from the British perspective. Yeah, I was just Calm down. Say,
it would have to be somebody from the marginalized population for the silliness Absolutely. To stick and to make sense. Because then it's lampooning.
This ain't is it, like girl.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with you. For sure. I would also add there's definitely some commentary on rank or class just jammed right in there.
Yeah.
Especially when only Sergeant Peach gets tea and explicitly names, you know, rank has its privileges. And it's a scene between two white men and a young black soldier. And every time this scene happens, I'm just like, what the fuck? Like, really? You're really going to put this simply on rank when two white soldiers are denying a black soldier, quote unquote, privileges?
Yeah.
And I'm so tired of shows being like, nope, we can only talk about either class, gender, or race.
Yeah.
They never exist within one person at the same time. That's not a thing.
What are you trying to do? Fill out a bingo card? We don't have that kind of time.
But there's obviously a racial dynamic happening here that they're just, you know, pretending doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And I think of the scene just right before this where all three of them are also in the same scene. Jack Daw is yelling at his sergeant because he's, you know, fed up with the mission.
Yeah.
And how much you want to bet that scene would not have played out the same with Vincey yelling instead.
Yeah. This is another great example of the limitations of colorblind casting, where it's like, yeah, you can say you're doing colorblind casting, but that actually just fails to actually reckon with the dynamics that are already at play in the scene.
Yep.
And if you were a little more conscientious or thoughtful about how you were building this episode, then you would actually use that to help unpack. If you're saying imperialism and colonialism are bad, then cast accordingly and do something with it. Don't just act like it's not happening.
Yeah. Like, casting people of color in your shows or your movies or any media isn't a quick fix, which is the whole point of, like, why colorblind casting is helpful alongside actual critical thinking.
Yes.
But it's not a quick fix. Like, the whole point of it is for you to interrogate how your scripts and how your stories play out if they included what looks like the world, which is more than white straight men. And if you're not interrogating that and you're just thinking, oh, I'll just put some black person here, brown person here, done, then you're playing yourself.
Yeah. The only example of colorblind casting that we accept is the TV version of Cinderella with Victor Garber and Whoopi Goldberg having a Filipino son.
Oh my god. I love it so much.
Literally the only the one. The
only Cinderella that matters.
Yes.
But also, I think they did it well.
Like, yes, it doesn't suck.
They didn't, like, they, if there was things to be addressed, they addressed them. Also, can we talk about Whitney Houston as the fairy godmother?
Impossible. Can we talk about, actually, before we talk about Whitney Houston as a godmother, which is incredible, and it was supposed to be, they were thinking about releasing it into a movie theater, but then they didn't, because it didn't test very well. Anyways, what the fuck ever, those people were wrong. But Whoopi, they gave her fake jewels to wear. Yes,
I just read this. She's like, nah,
and she
bitch.
Was like, you better fuck on off with that. And she got this, like, big jewelry house to lend her, like, $36 million worth of actual jewels. The power that
she does
has.
Not play around. She's just an icon since day one.
She has been.
Fucking love her. Anyways.
Anyways, we are focused.
Whoopi also wanted to be the doctor. And
oh my god.
I think Joe Martin has just got to be a shout out to Whoopi, because I feel like she has Whoopi energy.
She does have big Whoopi energy.
You know? Anyways, back to whatever episode this is.
I think we're on Bechdel and DuVernay.
Oh god. DuVernay. Joke.
Bechdel, I guess. I guess, yes.
No.
You think no? Even though Bill and Araxa talk to each other?
I refuse to give it Bechdel, because it's like, the script might as well have been, we're gonna pass the Bechdel test right here, watch it! This two-line interaction. We're Bechdeling.
I mean, I'm fine if it doesn't pass Bechdel. It's a gated script. I don't want to give it any cookies.
Sweet Jesus.
And no to DuVernay, obviously, because
such a thorough no.
Yeah.
Might as well have not put in here. Yeah.
Well, that's another Black Archive full of tedium.
Yay.
I'm really ready for something fun to break up these quarantine doldrums.
Okay, I got it. Let's head to the heart of the TARDIS. It may not be fun, but there's probably some feels.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. We can hear a word from our sponsor on the way.
This podcast is brought to you by Valkyrie Space Photography, built by some of the world's foremost astrophysicists and engineers. Valkyrie's technology can allow you to see other worlds like never before. Our patented cameras can take photos which act as a probe themselves, providing readings through our specialized spectrometer to give you crucial information about light, chemical breakdowns, geography, and more. When you're heading into a new frontier, you need the best technology by your side. Choose Valkyrie Space Photography as you fly into the unknown.
All right, this is the Heart of the TARDIS, where we talk about feels and or morals of the episode.
Okay, what do we have?
I guess choosing to die doing the right thing, a la Goodacre, Godsacre?
Talking about the commander?
Yeah.
Sure.
There's no one that can't be redeemed. That's a nice idea.
Yeah, I was kind of confused by his storyline, because it was very anti-military for a while, and then all of a sudden, very pro-military, pro-execution? I don't know.
I don't think this episode has itself sorted, but I would expect no less. Or I guess I would expect no more.
Really had me in the first half.
A Gatus episode.
Yeah, they had us the first half. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
It is very, it's anti-war at least, because there's the whole you must cooperate if you want to survive ongoing storyline.
Yeah, but that was also like directed towards indigenous populations. Colonizers are, you know, landing on your shores, and if you want to survive, because it's going to be bad news bears if you don't cooperate. So I'm just,
it's,
you know,
like, extra asinine in this situation, because the ice warriors can literally blast them to kingdom come.
Right.
So they have the upper hand now and forevermore. I don't understand.
I love how that's the plot twist, too. Yeah. Like, plot twist. The indigenous species is actually strong and capable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, as you said, the casting an eye askance at imperialism.
Don't belong. We're British.
We're British.
Things are getting,
I do love when he says they're getting desperate and then rings the bell.
Things are getting quite desperate. In that British accent. Oh, things are getting quite desperate.
goons. Cool.
Okay. I guess that's it for the heart of the TARDIS.
Really, really just thorough and rich material to work with.
Complex text. Shall we, as a sort of palate cleanser, send something to a crack in time and space?
Palate cleanser. Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. What are we sending this week, Caitlin?
I want to send maybe one of the most gaitest lines to ever gaitest. Our ice queen, Araxa, is saying,
"And you, female, what do you say?"
"Me?"
"We are both surrounded by noisy males. I would value your opinion."
So this is an eye-rolling example of a script performing feminism rather than being a feminist script. Like, there's, first of all, there's fucking two women in this whole episode.
Yep. Well, which there's like a handful of them unnamed in the NASA room.
Ugh, bitch, that doesn't count. Even our girl with the beautiful locks, like, she gets her shout out, but, like, she should have been in the whole episode. Cast her more. Anyways.
I think there's also, before you keep going, this episode as an example of just like, we're feminist, is this is the first time there's a female ice warrior. So you are spot on the money.
For real?
Yes. The first time.
Yikes. Cool.
Keep going.
That doesn't make it better.
No, it makes it worse.
Yeah. So they're like actively patting themselves on the back when they're like, this is the first female. And again, like, I just hate using that word, and basically is the point of my rant here, is that unlike the word woman, the word female is like super violent because it's a word that just does half of the work to reinforce a gender binary along the same lines as sex assigned at birth.
Yeah.
And just use the word woman. Like, that dignifies the gender of a person and doesn't pile on importance to a thing that is a construct assigned at birth.
Yeah.
Blah, 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 blah.
We talk about this in my classes because a sample paper that I use in our grading exercise uses female kind of inconsistently. But we always have this conversation where it's like, it costs you nothing to swap out female for woman. Yep. Like, literally nothing. And if it doesn't matter to you, it should matter to you. But even if it doesn't matter to you, it means the world to somebody else.
Exactly.
And that is worth it. It costs you literally nothing except for to think about it.
Yep.
Anyways. Keep going.
Exactly. That's exactly my point. So, basically, the scene is eye-rolling because, again, it's just performative.
Yeah.
And the lack of imagination is just fucking annoying at this point because, yet again, we encounter another species from another planet that just awkwardly assumes a biological sex and or gender binary that just so happens to mirror exact socially constructed binaries that we have to deal with on Earth.
We just talked about this in The Lie of the Land. We just talked about this.
The last episode. Like, whole episodes pivoting on the idea that biological sex and gender are just not things to be questioned.
Yeah, the binary is given.
It's just a given in this world. It's a given in another world, on another planet, in another galaxy. Anywhere you go, you're going to run into this because it's intrinsic. Furthermore, this is an indigenous population. Do you know how much more ridiculous that makes it? Because not even indigenous communities in the Americas have acknowledged only two genders.
Yeah.
That's on Earth.
That's true on our planet currently.
In one continent.
That's like Western culture is really into the binary, but other places are like, oh, it's a spectrum.
Literally, you made that. Anyways, so
what the fuck ever.
What the script is trying to, this is why it's so frustrating, because the script is really trying to say, I'm doing this thing, to say that the Ice Warriors are radical and subversive because their leader is a ruthless queen and she wants to hear from the females in the room. Cookies, please. But when you are first and foremost insisting on an unquestioned universal gender binary, not only are you not subverting anything, but you are actually reinforcing the narrative that says gender and sex are linked and their binary is so real and so intrinsic that it transcends across societies and planets.
Yeah.
That's utter bullshit.
It is bullshit.
Just totally ruins your whole I'm doing a feminism right now.
Yeah.
So I'm just really tired of all of that. And I would like to say, Gaitis, what? You can deal with big green Martians and rocket ships, but you can't imagine another society that isn't built around two genders?
No. Impossible.
Interesting. Also, it's ultimately saying that the Ruthless Queen is the villain, mm-hmm. so that's cool. And also, I'm always gonna look kind of askance at stories that give basically dreads to characters that are supposed to be coded as the villains. Because the Ice Queen definitely has some Brillo dreads here.
Yeah.
Which are actually pretty cool.
But they are cool, but
it's a part of the coding as, like, villainous.
So yes. That's bullshit. Yes. So, bye, Ronimo, to all of that mess.
Bitch.
What about top three moments? I think there are four, actually, right?
Yes, because I forgot to list one, but it's obviously, what does the pink thing say? Which, in my mind, I always hear as, what does the fox say?
Oh, no.
It doesn't ruin it for me, apparently. But it's such a great line.
It is
so
a good line.
So, out of this whole episode, Gatiss gave us that.
Yes.
And that's what I choose to hold on to.
Yes. I love when what the fuck Neville says, where were you all this time? And then he's like, were you on Friday's ship? And the doctor and Bill are like, yes, that sounds convincing. And the doctor's face, I took a picture of the screen good. Because I'm going to post it on our Twitter feed. I had to rewind it and watch it like three times.
Sure did. It's a great face. Yes. Just nails it.
It's so good.
He's so good at comedy.
Peter Capaldi is a fucking
They
gift.
Didn't tap into it for enough. So long.
I know. Not enough.
Oh my God.
Gatiss did give us a second really good line.
Tell me.
It's an a large, I mean, it's a good line, and also Pearl Mackey is very funny. It's, listen, I'm going to make allowances for your Victorian attitude because, well, you actually are Victorian.
She does do a great job with that line. It's really Bill. Congrats, Bill, for just existing.
Yeah.
Okay, I think that's it. No. Oh, no. I had another one, you're right. They're coming back to the TARDIS, and I always forget that Missy
is in there.
Is out. So when she peeks around the side of the console, it gets me every time. Because the doctor's just like, who the fuck's in here? And she's like, what's up, boo? I'm not doing nothing.
All right, I think that's it for this week. Next week, we'll be back to talk about the 10th episode of Series 10, Eaters of Light. I am terrified that we are already so close to Jodi.
I know. I don't think I'm ready.
There's only 4 Peter Capaldi episodes left.
Jodi is why I basically made you do a podcast with me. It's and true. I don't think I'm ready.
I know.
It's going to be fine. It's going to be great. Anyways, also, we were talking about how few moments we have to look forward to with Capaldi's run.
Yeah.
That's pretty sad.
That is sad. I wish he had a better last season. He has a great arc.
He has an amazing arc because he has an arc period, which doesn't happen with doctors on Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so satisfying, which is, again, what makes Jodi so satisfying.
Yes.
Them together, them as a pair, in a row, all of it.
Yeah.
I look forward to that, but please follow us on Twitter and Instagram and come cheer us up with other things to look forward to as we get closer and closer to some pretty rough stuff at the end of Capaldi's run.
God, his last two episodes are a bummer. It's the two speeches, by the way, in case you were like, what are the two moments you're looking for? It's
obviously.
It's Just Kind and his regeneration speech, obviously.
Obviously.
What else would it be? Okay. Again, follow us on all the things at Queer Archive Pod.
And you can shout us out. We want to hear from you, your thoughts on this episode or any other one. Cheer us up. Give us the stuff to look forward to besides those two moments. Please, please. Tell us to find another one.
We need a little hand-holding at the end of this season.
Yeah.
Please remember to rate and review us right now on your podcatcher of choice, because it really does help other queerdos find us.
Until next time.
Be gay.
Do crimes.
2 million your speakers and please be my doctor, whoever. Yeah. Uh-huh, uh-huh. Woo. Yeah.